Welcome to another full edition of After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. My guest for this entire first hour is a man who does his own podcast, but that's just one of the many, many, many things Ben Tanzer does. If you go to his website, as I think you should sometime later tonight, BenTanzer.com, you will read, I am an Emmy Award-winning coach, creative strategist, podcaster, writer, teacher, and social worker who has been helping nonprofits, publishers, authors, small businesses, and career changers tell their stories for 20-plus years. How the hell does somebody get in that kind of line of work, Ben?
I don't know. We should say, by the way, if I hadn't written that, it would sound really obnoxious. But since I wrote it, I'll have to embrace it.
He's not obnoxious.
I don't want to be.
He's a very, very personable, self-effacing guy. When did we first meet?
So we
met through the great, unbelievably talented improv artist Susan Messing.
Yeah, so it's funny. She was there the same night we were, but doing a different event. It was some sort of live stage show storytelling thing, and you and I were there at the same time, but with different shows. And I believe I decided to embarrass myself and walk up and express my great admiration for you. Susan helped me do that. Well, I'm a big fan of yours.
What possibly kind of show would I be doing? What was this?
You were invited in to be like an interlocutor or a host, and I was telling a story, and we were there on the same night, and Susan Messing...
I think it was some kind of international podcast festival.
Oh, yes, that's exact. Sorry, that's
it was. I think it was, and I've never done a podcast and barely listened to podcasts. I do listen to Ben's. You've been doing the podcast for how long?
So I figured out, because I've been doing a bunch of interviews recently, that we're probably going into the 15th year of that podcast. So
what's the seed of that thing? I'm fascinated with, last week I had on, I think you listened to some of it, you know, two Chicago newspaper reporters, hardened guys who have done a 12-part series as a podcast about the most unlikely spy you could possibly imagine, a guy named Dave Rupert, who brought down the head of the terrorist IRA.
I wish I did a podcast like that. You know, early on, I was on sort of assignment. I feel like I should do that with air quotes. There was a local magazine. The editor asked me if I would go interview the Bad at Sports podcast team. I don't know if you know Bad at Sports. It's a terrific podcast. So it already existed. I had a very simple recorder my wife Debbie had bought me so I could do interviews. And as I was interviewing them, they were doing a live podcast somewhere. And I remember I had this moment, which is no reflection on Bad at Sports. I thought, is this all there is? You talk to people and record it? I thought, I can figure that out.
Well, then the next question you should ask, and do you get paid for this?
I probably should have asked, because then I would not have been doing this for 15 years. There's not been a ton of payback. But... you know, it really piqued several things for me. So this is the real seed. One, I thought, I want to talk to writers whenever I can. Here's a great way to meet writers I don't know and admire.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately knew it would be a long-form interview, even though I didn't even know what that phrase was.
Sure.
That was part one. Part two, I thought, this will just be entertaining. And I'm very driven. You know, you read that intro, which I appreciate. But I always try to do things that I find fun. My mom always says, that's a metric for your decision-making. I go, absolutely. Pleasure is a big deal.
Yes, not money. Not money.
But I also saw it, and this is more crass. I thought, if I do this well, or even semi-well, it'll help me promote what I'm doing without me having to promote what I'm doing.
Interesting.
And so if someone comes to the podcast, then maybe they go to the website. If they go to the website, they see, oh, he's also an author,
maybe,
or he consults.
So
it was always all of those things at once.
But it's also, I've been doing radio for a long time, and I find it kind of almost like some ongoing graduate school where you can have on guests from whom you can learn things that you couldn't just call someone and say, hi, I see you've written a book about ancient Egypt. Do you have 45 minutes to talk to me on the phone? The answer is going to be no.
Right.
The answer is going to be no. So it's kind of a fair kind of trade-off, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Right. So you're fascinated either by a topic. Sometimes I'm just fascinated by the author. It doesn't even matter what they wrote. They seem interesting to me because of an interview I listened to. Recently, I'll do a shout-out. This is a little self-marketing, but... a publicist I'm friends with, a big-time publicist out in California, he said, would you interview one of my clients? So this, you and I talked about this a bit off camera or offline. You know, if it's someone I want to do a favor for, that immediately ups the likelihood. But he said, so yeah, one of my clients is the longtime director of the Oscars.
Wow.
Would that be interesting? He just wrote a memoir. And I was like, would that be interesting? I mean, I am a total celebrity hound award show, whatever. And I thought, so he wrote a book about it and he's going to give me an hour to talk about all of the things. Then I read the book.
Is it good? What's his name in his book?
His name's Jeff Margolis. The book is We're Live in Five. I mean, his first job was with the Smothers Brothers. It's a whole career and all these things I'm fascinated by. So, I mean, that to me, the goal was not to be a fanboy. You know, like
after 15 years, you have seemed to have lost none of your enthusiasm for the form, have you?
Oh, no, not at all. I find it so entertaining. And what's happened, and I say this with a smile, you know, I've also just tried to get better. So if you were to go back, this is before you and I met, the first 50 shows, I would interview anyone, anywhere, any level of noise, any amount of drinks, you know, and you can hear that. And later I thought, oh, let's up the game. And then I've always told this story. I had a guest on, Jennifer Pasteloff, who's a writer out west. And I just didn't understand what a big deal she was, which reflects poorly on me. But that episode got so much traffic. I mean, it was the first episode that immediately shot into the thousands, like almost immediately.
Do you have any idea week to week how many people are listening to you?
You know, it's several thousand every month, and it just sort of, it goes up and down, though, and that's interesting. I mean, I say this with love to all my guests. You can see a month where I chose people who nobody knows, and there's just less shows. So it actually bounces up and down. But I am telling you, some of those early episodes, I can say this now, we got like 15 downloads, 20.
Okay.
Oh, no, I always loved it. I never cared. But now it, but her, I want to give her part of the credit. I didn't know who she was, but we had a relationship. I didn't know how big a deal she was. That show was so big overnight that I thought, whoa, you need to rethink this. Even if you never have a guest this big, let's think about all of it. So then I had like a logo created. I made sure all the platforms were up to speed.
One of the reasons I like you and one of the reasons that Brett and Krista and Jack will like you too is most of the people we know in this business who dip their toe into the podcast world do so because they think that this is immediately going to lead to them being the morning man on WGN or some other station. You do it self-gratification.
Yeah, and let's be honest. I do almost everything based on self-gratification. I mean, I hope I'm giving. I hope I'm a good literary citizen. But if something seems like it'll be fun to me, if I'll be smiling at the end of it, that's always a reason to do it. And that's been my drive. And it wasn't always my drive, but it has been the last, say, 25 years.
You're going to get to know Ben Tanzer more intimately during this entire hour. Stay tuned for a short break, and we'll go back to his being born in Washington, D.C. and being raised in upstate New York.
Wow, yes.
That big, deep research, Rick, deep research. We'll be right back. I'm continuing on with Ben Tanzer, who is now telling me where he actually met me the first time. It was not at the International Podcast Festival or whatever that was.
Well, maybe that's the first time we formally met, and I decided to be a little less stalkery. No, the first time we sort of met was probably 25 years ago at the Printer's Row Fest. You were interviewing Studs Terkel. He is a hero to my family.
As I did every year at Printer's Row.
Well, it was new to me. It was great. So my mom was visiting. I said, we need to go see Studs Terkel together.
She's a big fan of Studs.
Oh, my gosh. She was, my grandfather was. Like, it's a whole family lineage.
That's great.
And so we went down to watch the two of you. And there was that moment where I thought, would love to meet Studs Terkel, but need to meet this Kogan guy, too.
Because Studs is really old. Kogan might be around longer than Studs. I'll
never
forget.
I went one for two, and I'm thrilled.
It couldn't have been 25 years ago. That was at the Washington Library during Printer's Row.
Yes.
In 2008 was the very last public appearance of Studs Terkel.
That's what we were at. We were there.
Wow.
And it was incredibly moving. It's hard to articulate. You know, it's like the DNA of your family.
Sure.
He was always part of a discussion. His books were always lying around the house. My grandfather loved him. My grandfather gave me my first Studs Terkel book.
That's great. Because one of the great things about Studs, having interviewed him 1,000 times and sort of growing up with him, is he was a born actor. He could barely hear. And all I needed to say with him is, Studs, Mahalia Jackson, Rick, I'm glad you mentioned her. And he would tell the most cohesive, wonderful, lively 20-minute story about his relationship with Mahalia Jackson. you were born with this nice studs-loving family in Washington, D.C. How long were you there?
So I was probably there till about the age of four. My parents are New Yorkers. My dad especially. Lately, my mom's been saying, well, your dad's the real New Yorker. Okay. They were both born in New York, but my dad was a real Bronx guy. They moved to D.C. because my grandmother had died, and they wanted to be near my grandfather. Wow. So we were there for about 4 years, and then they moved upstate New York. Which,
what for?
I'm not really sure. I wish I knew. I had a good answer for you. I mean, my mom had a job, got a job opportunity, but they were really city people, and I don't...
Where in upstate New York? How small a
town? I'm proud to say Binghamton, New York, okay. 50,000 people. It's actually gotten smaller since I grew up there. Now I think it's more like 47. It's a great... Well, let me say, I had a great time growing up there. Of course, I also haven't lived there in 30-plus years, but I don't know what they were doing there. They never fit in. I'm not sure they ever liked it, but my brother and I really thrived, and that was definitely part of it. And my dad was, my dad was an artist. I don't know if we've ever talked about that.
Visual artist? Painter,
yeah.
Sculptor.
Worked in ink, fine, worked in oils. He was a beautiful painter. He's a painter and a teacher.
Well, he was a painter and teacher. Your house was filled with literature, meaning stud circles, books, and I assume.
Oh, books and art.
And I assume others. What were you decided, your parents said you should go to college, man?
So it's funny. Never said it. And my dad was actually a high school dropout. They never said it, but it was presumed. And my younger brother, who has a PhD, so he has outdone me in every category, including height, which I'm very jealous of. But he said, well, didn't you think we were supposed to get PhDs? I go, is that why you have one? And he felt that that was an expectation. I don't think my parents ever talked about school. On the other hand, my mother got accepted to the University of Chicago when she was 15.
Wow.
I mean, she's a whiz. Wow. And so, academics were a big thing. And her father, my grandfather, got a PhD in his 60s, maybe, in anthropology, and then became an anthropologist. So
good Lord.
That side of the family was all about education. Maybe they didn't have to say anything. We just assumed.
So you assumed your way into what college?
I went to SUNY Albany, which I have to say I have a lot of good feelings about now. At the time, it felt like a place that a lot of us had gone to because we either hadn't gotten in where we wanted to get into or we didn't have the money to go where we wanted to go.
You were kind of disinterested high school intellectual.
Wow, you're really good at this, by the way. Yeah, I was a completely disinterested high school student.
And that's putting it kindly. There are other words I could use.
Yes, disinterested's good.
You can't say on the air.
Right.
Yeah.
No, definitely more focused on sports and dating and various abuses, being substance abuses. But what's interesting is, and I've told this story only recently, not that it's a profound, when high school ended, everybody I was directly friends with were all going to amazing colleges. And I had this moment where I was really embarrassed. And I thought, what was I up to that they're all going to Dartmouth and Georgetown? So I decided I would try really hard the first semester of college. And if I did well, I was going to obligate myself to keep trying.
Did
and then
you?
I did great.
Yeah.
And then I was stuck.
What'd you major in?
Double major, English honors and psychology.
Interesting. Interesting.
And the psychology I kind of stumbled into. I started taking the classes because I thought it would make the English classes more interesting. And it was actually a very easy major to finish.
Wow.
So I just added it.
At New York.
At SUNY Albany, yeah.
SUNY Albany.
Mm-hmm.
You met your wife in college?
Met her spring of freshman year. Fell madly in love almost immediately. Hope she's listening, but that is true.
Debbie, where's she from?
She is from, born in Brooklyn, grew up on Long Island, so she's like a real New York chick, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention, this is funnier now than it used to be, she's a Pritzker, but she's a New York Pritzker, so the non-moneyed, non-hotel branch of the family.
Spelled
but,
with an S, or what? How do they do
well,
that?
Well, it's spelled the same. Yeah. They're all from the same village in Russia, so I don't know what happened after that.
Interesting, interesting. Well, you don't have that kind of dough.
No, we blew that part.
You got out of college. You stayed with Debbie and didn't get married in college, but you got married
after
college.
Yeah, we were long distance for a while. So I woke up one day, and this, by the way, becomes a theme for the rest of my adult life. I woke up one spring morning, senior year, and I looked out the window, and it was raining. And I thought, okay, we're done with upstate New York. What does that mean? I thought, oh, move to California. People move to California. So I just announced it. I'm moving to the Bay Area. Who's coming? And so one of my friends came. Debbie did not want to go.
The Bay Area is not exactly immune from rain.
No, I don't know if I thought it out. But I think I had this idea that you go west and you find yourself or reinvent yourself. So we took a month. A friend of mine, Danny and I, shout out to him. We drove to San Francisco. Well, technically, we drove to Oakland. We lived there. I lived there for 2 years. Then I moved to New York City. I did.
What did you do?
I worked it out. I got a job. So I had this plan. I had no direction. And I thought, let's do this. We'll get a law job. And if that doesn't work out, we'll get a social work job. And if that doesn't work out, maybe a PhD in English. I had this very unplanned plan. So I got a big law, not a big law job. I got a job in a big firm. And I thought, this is miserable. Checked
doing,
it off my list.
What? Doing what?
Okay, this is embarrassing, too. I've used that word twice. So it was a firm focused on the asbestos cases that were really booming at the time. But what I didn't realize is that I was on the wrong side of that issue.
Right, right.
It took me about a year to figure that out. Then it took me about a year to get out of it.
The firm is saying asbestos is good for you. Asbestos
yeah, no,
is good
I really didn't understand a lot then. But I worked in this law firm, and I was a paralegal with no training.
Mm.
They gave me, I had, what do they call that? I had, like, subpoena power. I could subpoena records anywhere.
Wow. Wow.
If it was related to these cases.
Yeah, of course.
And that
course.
Part was fascinating. They would say, this was a factory that was open in Ohio 43 years ago. Do they have any records left? Go track them down. And this was pre-internet.
That is interesting.
So you'd be on the phone all day. You'd be pestering people. They'd say, oh, that's so-and-so. He retired. I have his home number. And you'd call someone and
but
they'd say.
Being on the wrong side of
but I was on the wrong side of it.
Did not appeal to you.
Well, as soon as I realized, I was like, hey, this is done. But also, I have to admit, I say this with love, I have lots of lawyer friends, people who worked at the firm all seemed unhappy.
Oh,
and so given that I'm driven by trying to be happy, I thought, maybe law isn't the way. So then I moved to New York City. I got a job as a caseworker doing kinship foster care.
Mm.
My dad had a younger cousin who was a psychologist at a huge place, the New York Foundling Hospital.
Sure.
He got me an interview, and then I ran with it.
And did you hook up with your girlfriend at that time?
So then we moved in together, right. So the whole California stretch, we would find each other in different places. Yeah, we lived on the Upper West Side. We're like the best or worst kind of New Yorkers.
When and where did you get married?
We got married in New York, but we are now living in Chicago. We got married in, what is the name of that town? We ended up, whatever the first town is between Queens and Long Island, we went to a bat mitzvah there, and it was like an old country club they'd renovated.
Oh,
and
nice.
We thought,
oh,
look at this, wood and grass. And then the night of our wedding, a hurricane hit, so all of that went to waste. Yeah, so then we got married. I'm sorry if Debbie's listening. I believe it's 1998 in New York, but we were living here.
Okay. And then, perfect way to end this half hour with you, what brought you two to Chicago?
Well, I'm very happy to say that I became obsessed after the Albany years with one day going to grad school in something at University of Chicago. And they
because
were nice enough
mom,
to let me
your
in.
Mom or?
Well, so she had gone there and she loved it.
Yeah.
And I'd had a friend out in California who'd been an undergrad and she always talked about it. And I thought, but it was also, it was both how they talked about it, but frankly, what the school looked like.
Yeah.
I thought, I want to go somewhere that looks like a
you
school
had,
like
you
that.
You had been here.
No,
or not.
No, I just fixated on it.
Wow, you didn't even look at it online. You must have just.
There was no online.
I know.
Yeah, I just fixated. I assumed it would be cool. They offered me a really big scholarship, and we just moved. We came out for 2 days, and then we just moved.
You live in Hyde Park?
Never. No, we always lived in the Gold Coast.
Wow.
Do you want to hear a good story? This you'll appreciate.
You got
we have
minute.
Time?
You got a minute.
I can do that in a minute. So we didn't know the city at all. And we were looking to find a bar playing the Bulls-Knicks game.
Okay.
And we're just driving around. And we end up at Burton Place in Old Town.
Oh, my God.
And we meet a bunch of guys, as we tend to do. And Debbie always meets a bunch of guys. And we say to the guys, where should a couple of New Yorkers live where there's a train and a supermarket? And they said, oh, you got to go live in Gold Coast. And they drew it on a cocktail napkin. And the next day, we brought that cocktail napkin to a rental place, and they found us an apartment.
Fantastic. I know a lot of jokers who used to drink at Burton Place.
I am one of those jokers.
You're not as big a
maybe
joker.
Maybe not one of those jokers.
You're not as big a joker as some of these guys. We're going to continue on now. We've got Ben Tanzer is in Chicago with his wife. He's going to have kids, and he's going to write books, and he's going to do a lot of other stuff. So please, please stay tuned after the news. Ben Tanzer, my guest for this entire hour, made the incredible leap to take advice from the denizens of Burton Place Bar at Wells and Burton, who recommended that he would recommend anything from those clowns would be something. But he took the recommendation to move to the Gold Coast, and he's been there ever since. You and Debbie moved there. You had two kids. You live there still. You love Chicago.
That's all yeses. We took that advice. We made that move. We had those kids. Yes, we love Chicago. And we're raising Chicago kids, which is so awesome and weird. We still feel like such New Yorkers, but, you know, I throw this word around, but very... I don't throw this word around, but we've been blessed here. You know, the kids went to great schools. We've been taken care of work-wise.
Public schools, too.
And great public schools. Franklin Fine Arts.
Where your son could both walk.
They could walk there, and we let them walk there, and we let them walk there during the winter. We got some flack from other parents for that. Somehow that it was too cold. I don't know. One kid went to Shy Arts, auditioned in. My older one, Miles, who's wonderful, and now he's graduating from University of Illinois next week.
With a degree in.
Very proud. He went to the College of Education. He's going to be an elementary school teacher and will be a CPS teacher.
He wants to be a CPS teacher.
He's a loyalist boy.
Good for him.
Yeah, and then our younger one went to Lincoln Park High School, like half the city. And he's graduating in 3 weeks.
Wow.
So somehow we did that.
Well, but the nice thing, too, is you allowed them to be in an era where it's increasingly difficult for parents to allow their children to be city kids.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We definitely tried. I feel like we did it. I can tell you, this has come up in other things. I won't bore you with all these stories, but I always was spent time in New York City as a kid. I love New York City. But I remember when I got to college... This will tie into one of your questions. We met people who'd gone to high school in New York City. It's the first time I'd met people besides like my dad. And I remember thinking, I want to raise kids like these people.
Yeah.
Like they're kind of sophisticated. They're overconfident. They've got some swagger. And even before I thought I'd ever have kids, I just thought if we have them, when I have them, they're going to be city kids. So yeah, I'm really pleased about that.
What does Debbie do?
So Debbie spent 20 years in advertising, first New York City and then here, and now she's been substitute teaching. So not only can we not get out of Chicago, we can't get out of Chicago public schools.
CPS.
Yeah, we are CPS loyalists.
Fantastic, fantastic. So you start to craft, when you're in Chicago, this multifaceted career, right? This, as I read at the beginning, when you go to Ben's site, BenTanzer.com, you will see near the very top of that site, after his list of activities, a shot of Ben taken at the Old Town Ale House.
Yes, sir.
Why the Old Town Ale House?
You know, this is funny, and it's a little, it's not pretentious, but it's something. Debbie and I walked by, we went there for drinks, and I remember thinking, and I didn't even understand its whole history. I want to be really clear.
Yeah, sure.
This could be 30 years ago. I remember thinking, if you ever get a book published and somebody wants to interview you, I want the first interview to be here. I actually had that thought. Like, I want the interview. Whatever this place is, I didn't even grasp it. Later, you're one of the people I met who said, you realize writers have been drinking there for decades.
Yeah.
I really didn't know. I just fell in love with the whole, it was a feeling. And so what's funny is, the very first interview I ever did, the person suggested Old Town Ale House. And I thought, it was right after my debut novel came out, Lucky Man, in 2007. And I didn't suggest it. And I thought, is this a real thing? This is going to happen? You rarely manifest those things, but apparently in that case I did.
Let's talk about your writing.
Please.
How many books now? The latest is, and we're going to devote some near the end of the show, to Missing, which is your best book. I will tell you that right now. You mature as a writer, and I've read not all of your books, but enough to tell you that. What started you writing in the first place? I mean, you have these other activities and you have other jobs,
yep.
And you and your wife are raising two little boys. How do you find the time and what compelled you to do it?
I believe now the compelling part of it was that as a senior in high school, I never thought about becoming a writer. I want to be really clear. It never mm-hmm. crossed my mind. I took a creative writing class, and I believe now you look back, I just got a lot of, I sound like a very new agey. I got a lot of validation in that. Like, people responded unusually. I'm trying to put actual English words together. The reaction was very strong to what I was submitting. I wrote a short story
from your teacher or from your classmates?
The teachers. Oh, I don't think my classmates were paying attention. That would have been awesome. But the teacher reacted unusually compared to other things I was doing. Again, I was an indifferent student.
Yeah.
So I wrote a story about suicide, which now I guess would probably get red flag, but at the time it was celebrated. I wrote an epic love poem about a woman I had met at running camp. I did go to running camp, and you know, the response was like, you've really got something. And so I don't think I let go of that. And at some point in college, I thought, could you be a writer? And I wasn't really writing, and I took a creative writing class in college, and I hated it.
Mm.
And I thought, well, maybe you can't be a writer, but I couldn't shake it. And, you know, the story, which is a bit like how I moved to California, I could never quite get the idea out of my head. I was always writing down short story ideas. And this is true. One morning I woke up, probably around 1998, and I was married. And for the record, I think I got married in 96. Apologies. So it was around 98, and I woke up one morning, and I looked at Debbie, and I thought, wow, this is nice. We're doing this. I was really happy. And I thought about my job at the time. I thought, good job. And I remember thinking, why are you unhappy? You know, like, why are you unhappy? And I thought, oh, and it hit me like lightning. You need to start writing. Mm. And within a day or two, I wrote my first short story. And now I've been writing almost every day since 1998. So that's how it started.
What's your writing routine?
The routine, the main thing is, how can I slot at least 30 minutes a day with as least stress as possible? And that's it. And I almost never write more than 30 minutes a day, but I almost never miss a day. Sorry for the people listening. I almost never miss a day either. It's just plugging away every day.
What was that first book? Was it Lost in Space?
So the very first book is a novel called Lucky Man, which is about four friends who meet in high school, and it follows them from high school through college and their first couple of years out of it. I guess probably in a way sort of a classic, hey, let's write our first book, let it be coming of age. But it was incredible because that book, and I know you can appreciate this, you're a beautiful writer, like I was carrying almost that whole book in my head for years. And around 2003 or four, I thought, okay, now you need to write a novel. So now we had a kid, and we were actually in Michigan somewhere, like Union Pier, for the weekend.
Sure.
And I thought, you're starting this weekend. And I wrote every day for 90 days and wrote that book start to finish, the first draft.
And you sold it immediately, or was that
No, but it did get picked up immediately. You know, the interesting thing is that book got picked up twice, and then both publishers abandoned their presses. So I was sort of sitting with it. And then it's funny, the week my second son was born, a publisher who is also a relative because he's married to my older cousin, he just wrote me a note in the middle of the night, and he said, you know, he was a publisher, and he said, you know, I mostly do graphic novels, but I think it'd be fun to do a novel. Do you have one for me?
Oh, come on.
I said, really? Because I have this one that's now been abandoned twice. And he published it.
His orphan, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, what's amazing, I know you know this, like, that first book came out, and all of a sudden, all these doors that I wanted to open, I mean, maybe not the biggest doors, I don't want to overstate it, but all of a sudden, you're a published author.
But it also had to be so empowering.
Oh, man, I was. Because also, something you alluded to, you've got two little kids. Like, I had barely started writing when we started having children, so I didn't even know what it looked like to have the freedom to write whenever I wanted.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, this guy, Steve Lafler, who I love, he just reached out, and I said, actually, I have a book that's just been abandoned twice. He goes, I'll take it.
You would be able to find on Ben's fine little website featuring a shot of him in the Old Town Ale House, seemingly, to my mind, seemingly sober. You will be able to find all of his books and be able to order them from the website, yes?
Well, the website will take you to wherever the best place to order them is, yeah. So maybe Amazon, maybe bookshop.org.
After a short little break, we're going to talk about the latest book, which is, because I don't want to give too much away about this remarkable novel called Missing. Missing is what book number?
Number 8.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe I haven't read all of Ben Tamser's books, but I've read Missing, and Missing is number 8. We will discuss that in a little bit of depth, trying not to give away too much after a short break. Okay, Ben Tanzer, this last book of yours, the 8th book, is titled Missing. It is a novel. It is a novel that focuses on family and troubles in that family. There's a, I don't want to give too much away, but a young girl named Krista is missing, and her parents, Gabriel and Hannah.
Yes,
okay,
correct.
Gabriel and Hannah are trying to deal with this. How does that idea, what's the seed of this story, if you can?
Oh, yeah, no, it's funny. In some ways, this is more straightforward than most things I do. I have an agent now for the first time after all these years, and I was having a meeting, like a coffee with her, and she said, what are you going to do for us? We want a novel. We want something that's more middle-aged focused. And I had this idea about a married couple over time, mm-hmm. and I had written a young adult novel I had sort of abandoned because it wasn't getting any traction. And I said, what about this married couple? And they've got a daughter. And I said, you know, there'll be different things, cancer and this and that. I go, oh, and the daughter will run away at some point. And it'll be one of the spikes.
And so your agent said, and we'll call it Gone Little Girl.
Right. Oh, my gosh. She did. I had to break her heart. But what was interesting was she responded very viscerally to the running away part. And she said, I want a whole book about someone running away. Can you do that book? And immediately, like other things, I suppose, my wheels were spinning and I could picture the whole book. But my immediate reaction was, yes, I can do that. And I'm not going to write about her. I'm going to write about the parents' reaction. So that doesn't give anything away. We know on the first page that she's gone by choice. This is important. With an older boyfriend, but it's not quite criminal. So nobody cares except for the parents. And that's what I ran with.
But what intrigued me about it, and I understanding certain difficulties in doing this, these are alternating voices of the parents.
Yes.
Through chapters. That's a bold decision. That's a big challenge for any writer.
Yeah, well, good. Yes, it is. Thank you. You know, part of my reaction to that was, if you're going to write about a marriage, you have to write about both voices. The question then, part of the challenge is not just two voices, but then being a male and wanting to do the female voice justice. And I've told this story, and it's true. I kept thinking, how would my wife Debbie or my mom Judy, what would they say or do in this situation? Mm-hmm. And then there's some other women I'm friends with, or my wife and I are friends with, who I just like. I mean, I just think
sure,
about
I
them.
I thought,
how would they react? And then the last, so I kept thinking, what would they do? Not what do I think they would do? What do I know they would do? And then the last thing I did when I was editing was I stripped out anything that reminded me of me, right? So anything to Ben had to go. What would Debbie say or do? And a couple of times, you know, both first my agent, then my editor were like, I don't like this line. Like, this doesn't sound like something a woman would say or do. Mm. And I knew it was something one of the women I admire would say or do. Not necessarily my wife or mom, though.
Right.
And so then I just stripped those things out. I thought, if you don't believe it, let's get rid of it. So I also was willing to get rid of anything that didn't sound like the character, even though it did sound like the character to me.
Did you let Debbie read this while you were writing it?
So let's do this delicately. I offered to let her read it, and now let's just leave it at that. She did not read it, which is totally cool. So yeah, I don't even know yet what her reaction is.
Dear kids, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, Missing is a great novel. Absolutely worth your time and available wherever books are sold. Your sons know what you do for a living, and do they care?
They sort of know. Do they care? I don't think so. They might. They don't express it, but of course they're young male humans. I will say, though, recently something happened to my older son, Miles, who I love, the one who's finishing up at school. He said, oh, this is real. I go, yeah. Yeah. He goes, people are responding to this. It's successful. I said, I don't know what the definition is, but people are responding. And then my younger one came to a reading for the first time with one of his friends. Now, partially, I was reading with another author that my younger son really likes. Give a shout out to Lee Matthew Goldberg, who's a New York writer. But Noah later was like, oh, this is like a whole so both of them have had a reaction. It's kind of like, oh, this is a whole thing. You don't just sit there and write, and you don't just sit there and send out emails. Like, people come listen to you. You're doing something. So this seems to be the first time it's actually resonating. But I will tell you a funny story. This has only happened once my entire life, but Miles happened to be there. We were walking down the street, and someone said, are you Ben Tanzer, the author? Miles is like 8. I said, I am. Thank you. And then Miles looked up and said, but he's not successful. So I know he's been paying attention because he knows that much.
What else did you do? What do you do to make money, Ben?
Well, I teach at Lake Forest College.
How long have you been doing that?
10 years. So there's they have a thing called the Chicago programs, and students move into the city for a semester, and I teach one of the classes they take. I do a May term class for them. I run a summer program for them. So that's one thing. I had been teaching at Columbia College as well the last couple of years, but budget cuts. And then I have two sort of consulting streams. There's a wonderful group I work with, the Montana Institute. They do social norms work, and I'm one of their consultants and trainers.
So
understanding where the positive norms are in a community and trying to grow them on behalf of different issues around social justice and equity. So that's a big push of mine. They have lovingly embraced me, and I appreciate it. And then I run a small strategy shop, and I do coaching, and I design workshops for people. So anything, I'm totally my dad. Anything to make money so then I can go write and do all the other things like podcasting that don't make money.
You obviously get enjoyment doing those other things.
Yeah, I would say more and more. I have been very fortunate. Most of my adult life, I've only done things I enjoy. And lately, it's almost entirely only things I enjoy.
Well, and you're not trapped in an office, are you?
No, I'm just trapped at my kitchen table, which frankly doesn't feel like being trapped at all. You know, I get to look out on our beautiful alley.
What kind of teacher are you?
So it's interesting. My focus is really on storytelling, personal narrative, and like career development. How do we become self-aware enough to do the work we want to do? And then how do we put the tools in place that lets us pursue that? So I'll balance it. Like one week we'll talk about emotional intelligence, but then the next week we'll talk about how do you create a kick-ass LinkedIn page? So I treat them all that they're operating on the same level. And if people can get their story down, then anything's possible.
During COVID, did you have to do remote? You must have had to do remote
learning.
Yes.
So one class was initially delayed, and then we got back to it. And I was insistent it could be taught remotely and on Zoom. I think I was correct. It's not as much fun.
Sure.
That class is back in the classroom. And I taught at Columbia. They were actually thrilled to have a remote class that gave more students options to take it. But then I asked if I could shift back to the classroom. So I do quite a bit of remote work, and I was doing quite a bit before the pandemic. So I will say, in a hopefully not precious way, that shift was not as big a deal for me. I mean, I did lose a lot of work initially. I hate to use this word, but I just pivoted in other ways. And where Zoom or whatever was Zoom friendly, I grabbed it.
And you're happy with your podcast?
I love the podcast. Great guests. Have a bunch of good shows coming up.
Who?
Oh, very excited. So Lee Matthew Goldberg, who I mentioned, who's a friend and a client. He's a crime writer from New York. He's terrific. Emily Schultz, another New York writer. Actually three New York writers. Dr. Syed Ali, who's an old friend from college, who's now a sociologist and wrote a terrific book called The Peer Effect. So all those shows are coming up.
What about, do you feel part of what passes now for the Chicago literary community? It's so vastly different. I have seen it change from, you know, the days of J. Robert Nash trying to beat up Nelson Algren to a vastly different world. Do you feel part of it? And what do you think it is now?
You know, that's interesting. That's a both and to me. So I don't have an MFA. I have a social work degree.
Yeah.
So I'm not part of those networks. So they've always been welcoming. So the people who went to Columbia College or the School of the Art Institute, like they have a thing. My experience was they let me more or less burst into it when I was ready. But I always felt slightly like an outsider. Huh. So I gathered other outsiders very consciously. What's changed a lot is I think the sort of indie scene, even pre-pandemic, started to break apart a bit. And a lot of those people I collected, for lack of a better word, some of them just stopped writing or they moved. And so I actually feel less part of something than I ever have. However, that is balanced by a vastly bigger Chicago plus network, where now I have friends and connections all over the country, which when I started all this, when I started the podcast, I barely knew anyone.
So I
am in some sort of sphere. I think I'm probably low-key Chicago. I mean, I'm proud of it. I hope I'm part of something, but it is a lot more disparate than it felt like 20 years ago. And it was very welcoming. I want to stress that. Like, nobody was necessarily inviting me to do things, but if I invited myself, most of the time someone's like, we can find something for you. It got me going.
Well, it's always mostly in the arts. It can be a very nurturing place. It can be, there's a little backbiting here and there, but in the main, it's a pretty nurturing environment.
Oh, I feel very taken care of. If anything, and I say this to anybody listening, I wish I'd been a little less aggressive and a little less desperate in the early years, like trying to catch up. So I'm sure I stepped on some toes because I was like a little too needy. But, people were great to me. And look, and I mean this, it's been a whole career. It's been a whole career that continues. And look, we're here today. I mean, that's amazing. I say that with love. Like, that's amazing to me. I'm thrilled.
Well, not a podcast. That's for sure. Not a podcast. You are a delightful guy and a very, very good writer. I can't wait to see what you challenge yourself tremendously in missing. Challenge yourself stylistically and psychologically too, I think. Are you working on something new? You're supposed to be writing every day, aren't you?
I know, right? So that's a two-part answer. The first part being, this is an unusual break for me, just for me, between books. So I had to be working other things. I got invited to pitch a nonfiction book about a year and a half ago, and that's with the editor. And I can tell you unquestionably, I'm not being self-deprecating. I think it's either a trash fire or a masterpiece. I'm not sure which. They will tell me. No response yet. So I'm thinking, okay, trash fire. You missed the mark, but I turn that in. And I am working on something new for my agent, and we'll see. That's an ongoing.
That's right.
Taking my time.
You do seem very happy. You've got two good kids.
Beautiful. Those boys are beautiful. Yeah.
I haven't met them. You've got a substitute teacher for a wife, and you got a mom who went to the University of Chicago. My dad went to the University of Chicago, and you live in the Gold Coast.
Boy, when you put it like that,
yeah,
I sound very fortunate, don't
nothing,
I?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong here. You might as well be one of the Daily family, for God's sake.
If they'd have me.
Yeah, really? Or that missing Pritzker family.
Oh, I know. We blew that one.
Missing Pritzker connection.
Man.
You can get a lot of information. I hope you got to know Ben over the last hour. But you can get more information if you weren't taking notes, and I hope you were not taking notes while you were listening to the show. Just go to Ben Tanzer, BENTANZER.com. You'll see what he looks like, and you will see what he does, and you will be able to order all of his books. Don't miss The Missing. Ben, it's always great to see you. Let's do this again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and I'd be thrilled anytime.
Sure. Write another book.
I will. For you.
Up.
I'll do
hurry
it with
up.
You.